We're in the middle of a series which is about life, death and resurrection. We've considered some things about life, some aspects of life. What is life? Some of the basics of this subject. What is life? What is death? What is resurrection? We spent the first part of our series doing that. And for everyone in the room, probably bar a couple of you, these are things that we've gone over a number of times. There's some fundamentals that we've looked at. This particular part of the series, we're now just going back and looking at subjects that are related and go beyond the basics, as far as I see anyway. And last week, we began a short part of this series, which is about hell, what it is and what it isn't. It's a highly contentious issue, Again, for those of you who may not have been here last week, we covered some ground which is sort of on this sheet here. Some of it is on this sheet anyway. I'll just go over one or two points to get us started. But I think it's rather important that we understand that the word hell in our Bibles, it really does depend on which translation you read as to how many times you see the word hell. For instance, if you're reading an NIV, you won't find the word hell in the Old Testament. It's just not there. If you read it in the King James Version, it's there quite a number of times. And the translators have chosen to translate certain Hebrew and Greek words in different ways. And it's one of the things that makes it rather difficult for us to study this subject. But if you have a basic understanding of how your translation treats this word hell, which I've got a rough guide here to get you started, if you haven't got any idea, then that goes some way to establishing some facts about what hell is and what it isn't. I bring us back to this chart that we've looked at almost every week because it shows us some basics that we've looked at. We won't go over all of this, but it's important that we realise that God alone has immortality. We do not have immortality. We can be granted immortality, but we don't have immortality. The resurrection chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, is very clear about this. How at that time, that is at the time of resurrection, the resurrection of the believer, we will put on immortality. This is a very, very fundamental principle when we consider these things. Because the traditional view, the common view, is that once we're born, we have an immortal soul that just goes on forever and ever and ever. And we either end up in heaven after we die, or we end up in hell after we die. Now that is really quite contrary to the scriptures, because immortality is something we have to be granted, and we are only granted that after we are resurrected. So yes, I would like to say that as a believer here, all of us are as good as sealed, if you like. We are as good as granted immortality, but we haven't got it yet. And failing some sort of intervention from the Lord in the meantime, let's just speak in bald terms, we can expect to die. Because we haven't got immortality. The other principal part of this is that when we consider what is life, then we have to consider the opposite, what is death. When we read in Genesis 2 that man became a living being because he was formed of the dust of the ground, and only then God breathed in him the breath of life. He then became a living being. The opposite of that, of course, is death. And Ecclesiastes tells us that at death, the spirit returns to God who gave it, and the dust returns to the ground. We read a number of times how there is no consciousness after death. David said a number of times, "In the grave, who will praise thee?" King Hezekiah, when he, in Isaiah 38, when he was about to die, he was very upset that he couldn't have more years to praise God. And we all know he was granted another 15 years, and he was very happy about that. And he used them pretty wisely too. Job knew these things. The writers of several Old Testament books stated these things. There is no consciousness after death. Last week we started talking about some Old Testament passages. Again, we're just doing a bit of a preview here. The Old Testament passages used the word Sheol, which means grave. So if you read in your translation, whatever translation you're reading, if you see the word hell in the Old Testament, it should read the grave. Remember, we looked at the word hell meant to be covered. It was that Old English word meaning covered. A helmet covered the head. A hellier covered the roofs of houses with thatching. Helling up your potatoes means covering in the ground. You're burying them. You're covering them up. And there's a few other related words there. So when we see hell in the Old Testament, it means grave. You won't see it if you're reading an NIV because it's not there. They've always got the word grave or something. And that is the Hebrew word Sheol. In the New Testament, we're going to look at this tonight. We haven't really looked at this part. When you see the word hell in the New Testament, most times it refers to a future judgment fire, and it's in a literal place called the Hinnom Valley. Don't worry too much about that for the moment. We're going to get to that. These words up here, I've got on a sheet here if you want to look at that later, if you didn't get one last week. The Old Testament Hebrew word is Sheol. It just simply means the grave or the state of death. The New Testament uses a very similar type word, but it's the word Hades. And there are two other words. One of them's Gehenna, which we'll look at later. And then there's a very rare one called Tartarus, which don't worry about that. We'll get to that sometime in the future. All right. What I want you to realize so far in summary is last week we looked at the word Sheol in the Old Testament. It means the grave. In the New Testament, the word Hades means almost the same thing, the grave. And in the New Testament, there is another very common word, and it is this word Gehenna. Sometimes it's translated hell, sometimes it's translated other things. But I want us to look at this word Gehenna. And I think you've got, hopefully, Matthew 5 bookmarked or close by, and I'll get you to go to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Now, if you remember, those of you who have an NIV, we read a lot of Old Testament passages last week, and you didn't even read the word hell. Until just at the last minute, just to prove it was there, we looked at this passage, and we'll start with this one. This is the Lord talking, the Sermon on the Mount, and he says in verse 29, you realise, of course, the Sermon on the Mount is a whole lot of do's and don'ts. Do this, this is a good way to live, don't do this, that's the bad way to live. And here's some of that. Verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, has everyone got the word hell there in their translation? But Ron Hodge hasn't because he's got an amplified Bible, and his word says is Gehenna, which is the word we're going to consider tonight. That's the Greek word. I think the word Gehenna in the original Greek occurs 12 times. And about six of those, it is directly associated with the word fire. It talks about fire in the same breath, virtually. All right, let's keep reading. So you've read there, it's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, verse 30, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, when we've got this is this word Gehenna, when we read this, it isn't Hades, it's not the grave. It's not a state of death. I think it will mean death for people, but that's not what it's saying. It's a little bit more than that. It is actually this place called the Hinnom Valley. Where's the Hinnom Valley? Well, it's there. It's south, just south of Jerusalem. I'll show you some pictures of it in due course this evening. This is the old city of Jerusalem, but right now the current city is built up perhaps around this. But there's the Temple Mount and the old part of the city, and there's a valley that runs down the south side and then also up the eastern side. And for those of you who know your geography of Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives is over the east, and there's actually a valley between the mountain and the temple as well. And it runs down the side and joins up with the Hinnom Valley along there. And how we get Hinnom, well, the Old Testament way of saying that was Gehenna. Gehenna. And we call it the Hinnom Valley. And it's a location outside of Jerusalem. And as I've suggested, I think it'll be used for judgment, but more on that in due course. The first thing we should realise is that every time, and I think I can say this fairly confidently, every time you see the word hell in the New Testament, where it is a translation of Gehenna, it'll depend on the translation you read, every time you read the word hell, where it's a translation of Gehenna, it means this place and things that will happen in this place. You can have a think about that. You might want to argue with that statement. But hear me out for a bit first. I think it means that place and things that will happen in that place. It's interesting. I mentioned that occurs 12 times. It's always by the Lord, or 11 of those times, I should say, are the Lord speaking. He's always speaking to Jews, except for one occurrence, which is in James, which is an epistle written to dispersed Jews. All right? Remember James chapter 1, verse 1, to the 12 tribes dispersed. So it has a very, very Jewish connotation here. Here's a general summary. You can probably go home in about 5 minutes if you've had enough. Here's where we're going tonight. I hope you'll stay around because I want to look at the scriptures. In the Old Testament, this Hinnom Valley, Gehenna, was a place used for pagan sacrifices by fire. People actually used to sacrifice children there. We'll look at some of those references shortly. By the time we get to the New Testament, it's a little hard to establish this 100%, but I haven't read anything to the contrary. It was probably Jerusalem's garbage dump with fires continually burning. Now, why would you have fires burning at the garbage dump? Well, it's to kill the pestilence, stop the spread of pestilence and disease. So in the Old Testament, people used to come out here and actually sacrifice children, and there's fire involved. We'll look at that in a moment. But and then by the time of the New Testament, it was the garbage dump and there were fires continually burning. Got a bit of a theme running through this valley of fire. Today, no fires. It's partly parkland and partly built up. And I'll show you some pictures of what it looks like today. It's sort of like a parkland section in the middle of the city. This is really the last one, when Christ returns. These are most of the New Testament references, what they refer to, I think, which is the fires will be relit, because there's no fires there at the moment, so the fires will be relit, and many people will actually meet their deaths there as a judgment takes place. And I think that judgment will take place when the Lord returns. There's going to be some people thrown in there. I mean, we've just read about how it's better for you to perhaps fix up your life and do those things correctly rather than be thrown into that place in Matthew 5, verse 29. Verse 22 is similar. I left that one because it's got some complexities about some of the Hebrew in there and the Aramaic. But yes, it's the same thing. You've got to be careful how you use your words. That's essentially what it's saying. All right, what I want to do now is go back, and we're going to start by looking at the Old Testament, some of the usages and the appearances. We're not going to finish this one tonight. It'll definitely be going 2 weeks tonight. Where are we going? I'd like you to turn back to Joshua chapter 15. Joshua chapter 15. And we're going to have a look at where this Hinnom Valley turns up and how it really became associated with fire and gradually became associated with what we understand as being hell. So Joshua, it's the sixth book of the Old Testament, Joshua chapter 15, and this is quite a straightforward one, I think. You remember that Joshua is the first book after the five books of the law, and this is where the children of Israel, they've tromped through the wilderness for 40 years and they're about to go in. In fact, they are actually in the promised land, and they're in 12 tribes, and the 12 tribes are given an allocation of land each. And here's one of them. This is part of Judah's land, the tribe of Judah, and you can see there's the overall map, and here's the part that Judah was allocated, and that little black part there is going to be the Hinnom Valley. We'll just read about it briefly so you get an idea that it is actually a physical place, literal place. Verse 8. This is the border. It's talking about the northern border of Judah's land. It says, "From then it ran up the valley of Ben-Hinnom," as the sons of Hinnom. So it's the Hinnom Valley. It's just another way of saying it. "Along the southern slope of the Jebusite city," that is, Jerusalem. And if you remember, the Israelites didn't take Jerusalem really until David's day. So that was a couple of hundred years down the track. But you can see that's just formed part of the boundary there. And if you really want to go and read Joshua 18, verse 16, you'll see the same sort of thing, except it's describing Benjamin's territory, Benjamin's borders, and how it runs just south of Jerusalem, of the Jebusite city, or Jebus. All right, now we get into, I want to talk about how it was a place of idol worship, and I'd like you to turn to 2 Chronicles 28. A little bit of Bible history coming up. And I hope some of the things we talked about in the overview of the Bible sections last year, will come flooding back to you instantly. 2 Chronicles chapter 28, we'll read the first few verses. Just while you're getting there, remember there's books of Kings and there's books of Chronicles, and some of them are parallel, but the books of Chronicles is exclusively about the kings of Judah. And the other kings are mentioned incidentally. All right, chapter 28, 2 Chronicles 28, and we're going to read about King Ahaz. Now the kingdom here is divided. I hope some of this is not new to you, but the kingdom was divided in the Old Testament. We've got all these other kings here, and here's Ahaz. Here's Ahaz here. We read, "Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. Unlike David his father," so back to King David all those decades and centuries before, "unlike David his father, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and also made cast idols for worshipping the Baals." So when it says the kings of Israel, he's talking about the other part of the kingdom, and all of these kings were rotters. There were 20 of them. There's not 20 listed there, but there were 20 of them, and they were all rotters, and they all worshipped false idols. So, and that's why it says that he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, because right, Ahaz was a king of Judah, not Israel. "He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and made cast idols for worshipping the Baals. He burned sacrifices in the valley of Ben-Hinnom," and that's the Hinnom Valley, or the Gehenna. "And what did he do? Well, he sacrificed his sons in the fire." So this is actually a literal, ritually offering up human sacrifices. "Following the detestable ways of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites, he offered sacrifices and burned incense at the high places, on the hilltops and under every spreading tree." Now, I think I have a picture. Yes. Here's... we don't have any exact records here, but here's what we think Molech looked like. It had a cow's head, and then there was a statue, and with arms either up like that or receiving, and underneath was a furnace. So you can see that something similar in that photo, and there's a person there offering up a small child. And he's not just going to place it in the arms only, that child's going to end up in that furnace there. And this was the god Molech. And this is what it meant by passing your sons and daughters through the fire, I think it says something like that a few times. It's a horrible thought. It's an absolutely horrible thought. And in a moment we're going to read in Jeremiah about a place called Tophet, which was a particular spot in the valley, because the valley's a few miles long, but there was a particular spot called Tophet where they used to offer these children, where this statue was. And they think that the word Tophet means drums. What's the relevance of that? Well, the idea was that they used to beat drums so they couldn't hear the screams of the children. And again, there's a little bit of guesswork by some of the scholars in that one, but there seems evidence for that. That's why it was called that. So it was a pretty horrible thing, but these people felt this was what they had to do. instead of worshipping the one true God. It's a horrible thing. And this all happened in Gehenna. So already you've got fire there. A fire of a sort, anyway. Let's go back, though, because I want you to turn to chapter 31. 2 Chronicles 31. Ahaz was not such a great king. But Hezekiah wasn't too bad. He had his down points, but he wasn't too bad. And we read here about Hezekiah, and you can see Hezekiah was the next king after Ahaz. The next one. Chapter 31, verse 1. When all this had ended, and you'll have to read what happened before that, he basically got the whole nation together and said, worship the one true God. When all this had ended, the Israelites who were there went out to the towns of Judah, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. These are all idols and used for idol worship. They destroyed the high places and the altars throughout Judah and Benjamin and Ephraim and Manasseh. After they had destroyed all of them, the Israelites returned to their own towns and to their own property. So what we find there, or it becomes evident, that King Hezekiah actually destroyed that place. Because he got rid of it. It was just south of Jerusalem, just where he was reigning. He got rid of it. It would have been very, very prominent. Everyone would have known. Everyone in the city would have known about this place. And so he got rid of it. Chapter 33. We read about the next king, Manasseh. And Manasseh was one of the worst kings of Judah. Chapter 33. He was the next king. So we've got Ahaz, not so good. Hezekiah was pretty good. Manasseh, not so good. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 55 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. And that's referring to when the children of Israel came in the promised land. He rebuilt the high places his father Hezekiah had demolished. All right, so he's put up this monument to Molech again. He rebuilt the high places his father Hezekiah had demolished. He also erected altars to the Baals and made Asherah poles. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshipped them. So that's star worship and to do with the zodiacs and things like that. He built altars in the temple of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, my name will remain in Jerusalem forever. In both courts of the temple of the Lord, he built altars to all the starry hosts. He sacrificed his sons in the fire in the valley of Ben Hinnom, and practiced sorcery. And you can keep reading, he did some pretty other horrible things. But Manasseh took his own sons there and did that.
So ironically, he could only do it because his father hadn't done the same thing.
Oh, that's correct, yes. That's right, because Manasseh was the child of Hezekiah. Now, all these kings, not all of them, but most of them were actually sons of the one that came before. There's a few little hiccups in the line there, but essentially they're all descendants of each other. Yes. And as Athel just pointed out, Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh, but it's ironic that he chose not to sacrifice Manasseh. And we don't know if they sacrificed all their children, some of them, we don't know. But Manasseh was obviously spared for whatever reason, because Hezekiah didn't worship Moloch in that way. He didn't sacrifice the children. 2 Chronicles 34, the next chapter. So we've got Ahaz offered children to the fire. Hezekiah didn't. Manasseh did. We're about to find out that Josiah, the next king, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord in this instance. Chapter 34, verse 33. Josiah removed all the detestable idols from all the territory belonging to the Israelites. And he had all who were present in Israel serve the Lord their God. As long as he lived, they did not fail to follow the Lord, the God of their fathers. So, I mean, that last verse says everything, doesn't it? As long as he lived, as long as Josiah lived, the people did not fail to follow the Lord, the God of their fathers, as opposed to false gods like Molech and Asherah and Baal.
Is there a pattern that you had a good king of Asherah and a good king of
Judah? No, not really. There was just for that short period. But there were 20 kings of Judah as well, and only 8 of them are said to have done what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and some of those 8 had bad patches too. So there's only about 5 or 6 of them that of where they didn't go into this false worship at some time. I know this is a long-winded way to get round to talking about hell and everything, but I want to stress the point here, and you should be aware that this is the history of the Old Testament leading up to the New Testament when the Lord starts talking about hell. He's not talking about a traditional place that we traditionally associate with souls burning in flames forever and ever and being tortured, and there's Satan standing up there with his pitchfork. He's not talking about that at all. He's talking about this sort of place. He's talking about a literal location. We should be aware of that. I'd like you to now turn to 2 Kings. This is a sort of a parallel passage, and it gives us a bit more information. 2 Kings chapter 23. Hang in there, everybody. I know it's not easy. 2 Kings chapter 23. I think this subject of hell is so confused the church over the centuries, I think it's worth just spending a bit of time trying to figure out what's what. Chapter 23, verse 10. Now, this is about Josiah again. And we read, well, he's in the process here of destroying a whole lot of idols and that we've just read about in the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles. But verse 10, we read specifically that Josiah desecrated Topheth, which was in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. Now, can I get back to my map here? Yes. We're not sure exactly where in the valley of Hinnom this was, but it was a specific place. And it was a specific place where that statue was and where these particular sacrifices were being held. And so he actually defiled that place so that so no one could use it to sacrifice his son or daughter in the fire. So he didn't actually, it doesn't seem as if he sort of just got rid of the whole thing. It's a bit hard to tell exactly. But he did desecrate it. The problem was that these last two kings, the last three kings, there's another one just in the middle there that isn't listed, the last three kings again fell back into that old habit of worshipping the idols. And what we're going to do here is read about some of them in Jeremiah, Jeremiah's prophecy, chapter 7.
When you read it like that, it's so clear about why God just had enough and exiled them. You know, back and forth.
Yeah, what Janelle's referring to there, in case you're not aware, is that all the way through this period here, the prophets were being sent to Israel and Judah to turn back to the one true God. Stop worshipping these false idols, which they just continually did. The kingdom of Israel, that there weren't really any worshippers of the one true God in that time. During the kingdom of Judah, they lasted a bit longer. And you can see one of the punishments we're told, or specifically we are told, that they were exiled, they were overrun by the Assyrians, they were kicked out of their land, and it was because of their idol worship. Judah lasted longer. There were some good kings. They were allowed to last in their land about another 140 years longer. But, again, as Janelle sort of mentioned there, no wonder they were exiled at the end. They just kept on falling back into this old habit. They'd reform, and then they'd go back. They'd reform, and then they'd go back. And eventually it just got to the point where God said, had enough. I've warned you too many times. You've had enough. I've had enough. And in fact, what we're reading here is a passage from Jeremiah, and you can see where the spot is up there on the chart, that Jeremiah, his ministry, his preaching, his prophecy, if you like, was during this time, some of the years of Josiah, but then right in during the last few kings, and then into the exile time. And what we're going to read here is a portion which I think was written during the times of these kings who were worshipping, going back into idol worshipping again. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 31. It's sometimes a little difficult to tell when we're reading Jeremiah what's actually the contemporary histories, but it becomes obvious, I think, once you read the context. The people of Judah, this is the Lord talking through Jeremiah, of course, he says, verse 30, "The people of Judah have done evil in my eyes, declares the Lord. They have set up their detestable idols in the house that bears my name and have defiled it." So you put two and two together, Josiah cleared Judah of all those idols. Jeremiah is talking now during a time, these last three kings, when these idols had been put back up again. They've set up their detestable idols in the house that bears my name and have defiled it. They have built the high places of Topheth in the valley of Ben Hinnom to burn their sons and daughters in the fire, something I did not command, and as if to just add the emphasis here, nor did it enter my mind. So beware, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when people will no longer call it Topheth or the valley of Ben Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury the dead in Topheth until there is no more room. Now, it's difficult to tell, is this referring to the time of the exile, or is it referring to some time, you know, still future, when the Lord returns and there's going to be some destruction and some judgment? I suspect a little bit of both. The time of the exile, in one sense, prefigures the return of Christ in some ways, the judgments that will come. And I think that's part of it. We read a little bit more of this in chapter 19. I'd like us to read each of these references.
So it's suggesting that the voices of the bride and the bridegroom of the Lord Jesus coming, you know. Jeremiah, just the last couple of verses in 7, chapter 7.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, verse 34.
You think that might be referring?
It's certainly, in one sense, it was really directly referring to the exile time that was just around the corner. If they didn't turn back to the Lord, which we know that they didn't turn back, because it talks about the towns of Judah, the streets of Jerusalem, the land will become desolate, which it did. These sounds of joy, well, they certainly disappeared. What I meant by there being a parallel was that there is a parallel with the judgments that took place and the exiles and the judgments that will take place when the Lord returns. Just in that sense, there are some parallels. Okay, chapter 19, verses 1 to 15. Yeah, I hope you don't mind us just going into some detail about this. I think it's important to build up a picture here. Some Bible studies are quick and easy and some of them aren't. And this is probably one that isn't. Chapter 19, verse 1. This is what the Lord says. Go on by, so he's talking to Jeremiah. He says, go on by a clay jar from a potter. Take along some of the elders of the people and the priests and go out to the valley of Ben Hinnom. So it's the Hinnom Valley, near the entrance of the potsherd gate. There proclaim the words I tell you and say, hear the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah and people of Jerusalem. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Listen, I am going to bring a disaster on this place that will make the ears of everyone who hears of it tingle. For they have forsaken me and made this a place of foreign gods. Now just go back a second here. He says, I'm going to bring a disaster on this place. So it's obviously still while the kingdom is standing, but it's on its last legs. It's shaky. It's really shaky at this time. They've actually got other powers sort of ruling over them. But that's there. I'm going to bring a disaster on this place that will make the ears of everyone who hears of it tingle. Verse 4. For they have forsaken me and made this a place of foreign gods. They have burned sacrifices in it to gods that neither they nor their fathers nor the kings of Judah ever knew, and they have filled this place with the blood of the innocent. They have built the high places of Baal to burn their sons in the fire, as offerings to Baal, something I did not command or mention, nor did it enter my mind. So beware, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when people will no longer call this place Topheth or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, but the Valley of Slaughter. In this place I will ruin the plans of Judah and Jerusalem. I will make them fall by the sword before their enemies, and this is exactly what happened. At the hands of those who seek their lives, I will give their carcasses as food to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. Now that's interesting, that verse there, where it says, in this place, so it's talking about the Hinnom Valley, the Gehenna, in this place I will give their carcasses as food to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. We're skipping forward a few studies here, but there's a passage, there are a number of passages that talk about how, particularly in Isaiah 66 and Mark 9, that talk about how bodies will be thrown into hell, quote unquote, meaning Gehenna, where the worm dies not. And people will actually stand and be able to look at that valley and see carcasses that are being devoured. There's fire, and what the fire doesn't get, the worms will get. Again, we're skipping forward a little bit here, but it's putting these ideas together. It's a literal place. It's not going to be a happy place, but there's death and destruction there. We'll just go verse 7 again. In this place I will ruin the plans of Judah and Jerusalem. I'll make them fall by the sword before their enemies. At the hands of those who seek their lives, I'll give their carcasses as food to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. I'll devastate this city, make it an object of scorn. All who pass by will be appalled and scoffed because of all of its wounds. I will make them, this is awful, I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and daughters. And they will eat one another's flesh during the stress of the siege imposed upon them by the enemies who seek their lives.
I'm interrupting a lot, but when you think that was taking place or is to take place?
I think that took place. But again, as we've looked at with a number of these Old Testament prophecies, sometimes there are dual, I was going to say fulfillments. That's not quite the word I want, because sometimes it will come to pass twice.
It was extremely, what's the word I want, it was thoroughly fulfilled during the siege of Titus in AD 70. They were eating their sons and daughters in the siege.
It came to pass in a very literal way. I hesitate to use that word fulfilled.
It's almost as if God is saying, all right, you want to sacrifice your sons and daughters? You can eat them.
Yes, and here's a place. You can just use that place again. You can use that same place. Folks, I just need to keep reading a few more verses. That's okay. All these comments are helpful. Verse 10. Now, remember, Jeremiah had been told to take a jar. It says, and the Lord says, then break the jar while those who go with you are watching. And say to them, this is what the Lord Almighty says, I will smash this nation and this city just as this potter's jar is smashed and cannot be repaired. They will bury the dead in Topheth. Remember, Topheth was the place where that statue of Molech was set up, and people were the actual literal location where people were sacrificing. They will bury the dead in Topheth until there is no more room. This is what I will do to this place and to those who live here, declares the Lord. I will make this city, I will make Jerusalem, like Topheth, just round the corner there. The houses in Jerusalem and those of the kings of Judah will be defiled like this place, Topheth. All the houses where they burned incense on the roofs to all the starry hosts and poured out drink offerings to other gods. Jeremiah then returned from Topheth, where the Lord had sent him to prophesy, and stood in the court of the Lord's temple and said to all the people, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Listen, I'm going to bring on this city and the villages around it every disaster I pronounced against them. Why? Because there's a stronger power coming? No. Why? Because they were stiff-necked and would not listen to my words. These are long readings. There's a lot in them. I hope you're building up a picture. I want to read one more passage and then I think we'll finish for this evening. And it's in Jeremiah 32. Our first verse is verse 28. And we read here from, let's go from about 26. Let's go from verse 26. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me? Come on, Janelle, you can join us. We've just read Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah 32, verse 26. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me? Therefore, this is what the Lord says. I am about to hand this city over to the Babylonians and to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, who will capture it. The Babylonians who are attacking this city will come in and set it on fire. They will burn it down along with the houses where the people provoked me to anger by burning incense on the roofs to Baal and by pouring out drink offerings to other gods. The people of Israel and Judah have done nothing but evil in my sight from their youth. Indeed, the people of Israel have done nothing to provoke me with what their hands have made. In other words, the idols, right? They had to make the idols with their hands, declares the Lord. 31. From the day it was built until now, this city, that's Jerusalem, has so aroused my anger and wrath that I must remove it from my sight. We'll just skip down to about verse 35. And he tells them all the things that they've done. And amongst them is verse 35. They built high places for Baal in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. That's the Hinnom Valley again. To sacrifice their sons and daughters to Molech. Though I never commanded nor did it enter my mind that they should do such a detestable thing and so make Judah sin. You are saying this about the city. By the sword, famine and plague it will be handed over to the king of Babylon. And then he tells them about that too. But so he's, again, just warning them and telling them it's because of that and that worship to Moloch and that particular type of worship that happens in that valley that this destruction will come upon you. A final thought here. I want to just move forward to the Lord's time here. And we read in Matthew 5 about how if it's better for you to lose a body part than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And we can just read one or two of those, actually. I think that'll be good. Look, go to Matthew 18. I think Michael actually mentioned this one before. Matthew 18. Because what I want to do here is just associate this place in Gehenna with it being in later times. We're now talking about 500 or 600 years later than the exile, up to the Lord's time, it being a garbage dump where there were fires burning continually. Now this isn't the actual picture of the Hinnom Valley, but it's perhaps what it might look like or what it may have looked like at the time. Matthew 18 verse 9, and we'll talk more about these terms about everlasting fire and things next week, I think. Chapter 18, verse 9. It's a very similar verse. The Lord's saying, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life. And when he's talking about entering life there, I believe the context is resurrection life, the kingdom on earth. You can argue about that one later. But it's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. In other words, the fire of Gehenna. That's what it literally says. Rather than for you to be thrown into the burning garbage dump. Let's put it that way. So, I mean, it sounds silly. This is a preposterous idea to many people. But when we read that word hell in the New Testament, especially if you're reading in NIV, It's almost always that word Gehenna, and it's referring to that place and the fires and practices that relate to that place. Not somewhere deep under the earth, a cavern filled with flames and darkness and Satan standing there with a pitchfork. It's referring to that place, just outside of Jerusalem, fires and judgment that will take place. And it's interesting because when the Lord returns, he's going to also be the righteous judge. There is judgment at his return. I think we should just briefly look, there's a number of other references, but just to finish off the study tonight, I just want to show you a little bit of what it looks like today. It actually looks so nice you could probably have a picnic there. This is the Hinnom Valley from a number of different perspectives. This particular one you'll see is just about the postcard shot, this one here where you see this lovely little parkland. But you can see there's quite a few buildings around, and this is on the southern side of the city of Jerusalem, of the what we call the Old City, and these are the older buildings here. There's actually a road that goes along the valley. This you may not be able to see it so clearly from there, but there is actually a dip in the skyline there, and you can see it's a valley. So that's what it looks like today. It's not too bad today. But in the future, at some time, perhaps it won't be such a pleasant place. All right, I think that's about really all I want to do. That's about all I want to do tonight, I think. Next week, I want to look more at some of those future references, more of the New Testament references that particularly refer to a judgment in the future, and that's when it gets a bit nasty. So I do apologise for that being a little complex in places tonight, but I hope that you get a picture of the overall sense of what happened in Gehenna in the Old Testament, and perhaps what the sorts of things we can expect to happen in the future. We'll do more of that next week.